Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Tuesday, June 16th. Chicago construction crews are scrambling to put finishing touches on the 19-acre campus of the Obama Presidential Center before its formal dedication later this week. Recovery from the super typhoon Sinlaku in Micronesia is slow going. An existing worker shortage is hampering efforts to maintain critical infrastructure. What the view from above can tell us about the health of dolphins, how drones are teaching us about our undersea creatures. And we mark a loss in the tight-knit community of Kalaupapa, signaling uncertainty ahead for the tours of the settlement that were only recently restarted after the pandemic shutdown. Plus, we learn about Bleak Week in June. We find the beauty in emotionally challenging cinema. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It's been more than a decade in the making. The Obama Presidential Center will open its doors to the public Friday, Juneteenth, a fitting tribute to this nation's first president of African-American descent. This week, HPR is featuring stories about this milestone. We were there in Chicago earlier this month for a sneak preview.
10 seconds from now, the polls are closing in California, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and also in the state of Hawaii.
Senator Barack Obama will carry the state of Virginia. This is an important win for Senator Obama.
Barack Obama will be the 44th president of the United States.
What a symbol it sends outside this nation and then inside this nation. The promise of how great America can be.
Barack Obama
is the first president of Barack Obama. Und er
Barack Obama becoming president-elect.
Tonight, history made in the United States. Barack Obama sweeps to a massive win as the country's first black president.
You may recall that the University of Hawaii and Columbia in New York were in the running with the University of Chicago for the library. Lynn Sweet is a special correspondent for Chicago Public Media, which owns WBEZ and Chicago Sun-Times. Sweet has the long view on the center, having served as the Washington bureau chief for the Times and covering President Obama. I talked to her just before the media was given a preview tour of the museum about expectations. It was a beehive of activity as construction crews scurried around the 19-acre campus to put the finishing touches before the formal opening.
When this project was first conceived, there was intense competition between bids from Hawaii, Columbia University, and in Chicago, a bid that was overseen by the University of Chicago for various sites on the south side of Chicago. But the thumb was always on the scale for Chicago, to the degree that at a press briefing that CEO of the Obama Foundation, Valerie Jarrett, just held minutes before we're speaking, she said, open quote, he knew he wanted it to be on the south side of Chicago.
You know, and we're here because we wanted to see what was the story that was told about his time in Hawaii. Because, you know, they make him out to be, well, he's the first black president.
Well, I haven't seen the exhibits yet. And the whole part of the story, when Obama says he stands on the shoulders of the people who came before him, the leaders of the civil rights movement, this is not a new theme for him. I know he talked about the Joshua generation when he was at a church in Selma. Years ago, talking about whose shoulders he stands on. There's a reason why the John Lewis Garden is here, the great former, now deceased congressman and civil rights leader who's, was beaten in the Selma March. It's upon shoulders of people like him that Obama says he stands on, and I think that is a reason why it was important for him to have some naming and dedicating something to him here.
And then as far as the center uplifting this community, because they really underscored that this morning.
So I'm talking to you in the context of where the city of Chicago, state of Illinois, as other areas in this country, particularly blue states and blue cities, have had been punished by the Trump administration. Grants taken away, certainly we've had very brutal immigration raids in this city just a few months ago, stepped up deportations. Valerie Jarrett made it clear when I asked about this context of the times that they're in it for the long haul, here to be a message to next generations. And I think it can be summed up by the letters on the south face of the building, which come from some speeches and important Obama sayings. Some of them are hard to make out, but the one thing that you can see that does jump out is, yes, we can. Yes, we can was a signature call and response from the 2008 Obama campaign. And that is, in my analysis, the spirit and the values they're trying to put. Since this place will be here in perpetuity, this place will be here for the ages. And I think they have the presumption that the way things are today are not the way things will be tomorrow.
And as you prepare to go in here, is there anything that you'll be looking for to see what they play up, let's say, with his foreign policy, domestic policy?
Well, I have covered Obama since he, you know, I started covering him when he was a state senator, quickly got elected senator, and the campaigns, the 8 years of the administration, the post-presidency. So for the moment, I want to see everything.
And he talked about how he was looked at as an outsider here. People weren't sure if he was black enough. He had a funny name, and they were real curious because he was raised in Hawaii. I mean, I'm looking for what narrative they give with that and how that fits in to the South Side. But I don't know, do you have a different view?
That didn't come up. That was an issue in terms of his racial identity more when he ran for Congress the first time in a Southside district against Bobby Rudd.
Yeah, he did mention that, yeah. But you think that's just faded away now?
I don't know. I mean, I have to see the exhibits to see. If in that context, I don't know what it is.
I don't know. Anything else that you just want to share with our listeners? Just because you watched him, go from the Chicago house here to the big house, the White House.
Well, I am interested to see how some of the promises made unfold, the promise for this to be an economic engine for the South Side, which has needed for decades more attention, more resources, more assets in this community. Everyone is very hopeful that indeed that the tourism business will be strong enough to have some meaningful change here. And that just is what we'll be watching for, among other things. But you can see I walked around here a bit earlier today. There are some pretty terrific spaces here, especially the playground. It's just colorful and imaginative and spectacular. You know, we are sitting on 19.3 acres that was part of Jackson Park, public land, big controversy about whether it should be built here. So a lot of the space here, such as the playground, will be open to the public to play, sit, eat, reflect, walk around. You know, that is part of the obligation that they took on when they got the land.
And then I guess it just remains to be seen when they talk about no public funds were expent.
There was public money for the infrastructure improvements. Well, I've covered this project since before it was a project. I knew from the day Obama became president that one day there would be something like this. And I think I always would have bet it would have been in Chicago and probably on the South Side. You know, which of the different sites, I couldn't have been sure. But it is interesting for me to see how this story ended now that I'm here at the opening, since I was here at the beginning.
We've been hearing from veteran Chicago journalist Lynn Sweet, who sat down with us before the media preview of the Obama Presidential Center earlier this month. And, you know, that day we also came across a trio of students who were heading home after school. Their campus is in the shadow of the center, and they were looking forward to spending time getting to know the new additions to the neighborhood. We talked to 10-year-old Madison, 4th grader Lyric, and 6th grader Jakyla.
What do you think about this library?
I think it's going to be pretty nice.
And what do you know about President Obama?
Well, in Chicago, or like in other states, I know where he live at in Chicago, because we walked past it a few times.
And you know, like, yeah, his daughters were born here, right? And Michelle's from here?
Yeah, I forgot his mom and his dad's name, but we was doing a science thing for him.
Oh, a science project?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I don't know, are you anxious to go in and see what it's like?
Yeah, I really will go in, but that's if I have some money, because they say you have to pay tickets.
And so what do you think about this library?
That it's a great place where kids and people and grown-ups can read about books or print something out.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think about President Obama?
That he's a good president. And also I know his wife, named Michelle, she was good to the community, too.
Good role model.
Oh, and we saw his house. It's like a flu box away from their house. It's not that far.
So you know where he lives?
Mm-hmm.
I know his birthday is August 4th. Yeah, his daughters, they was here.
And what do you think about having this library in your neighborhood?
I feel like it's a good thing, because it's like really putting Barack Obama in a good place, and it's like supporting him a lot, and I'm glad that they like put this up and like got the letters and stuff up on there. It's really cute and I really like it.
What do you think it means to have it so close to where you guys live?
I feel like it's a good thing, because it's kind of like supporting the school a little bit too. So like, yeah.
I say so.
It's like say if you was like getting boring and you would like to go read books or something. Yeah, it would be really nice if then you go like with your family members and stuff, and then when you're done, they could like go out to eat or something.
Yeah, there's some place to hang out.
It's very connected to like our schools. My opinion is I think it's connected to all the schools.
Yeah. Okay, and you?
Because you could just walk a few blocks away to the school and you'll be already there. The school just right there.
Yeah. No, it's impressive. Between the playground and the courts and the library. The library's awesome.
And I think Michelle Obama and Barack Obama are two great people. And I really still wish he was the president, because he was one of the most greatest presidents. Not trying to hate on none of the other presidents, though. But I feel like he was a very great president.
And President Obama flew into Chicago this past weekend for a walkthrough of that new playground and a pickup game at the new home court, the Olympic-sized basketball gym. We'll have more on the president's love for basketball, so stay tuned.
Live from the Atherton presents Inside the Song, an intimate evening of live music and conversation featuring Nā Hoku Hanahana Award-nominated songwriters sharing the stories behind their songs. Presented in partnership with the Hawaii Academy of Recording Arts. Tickets are limited and available at hbrtickets.org. This event is sponsored by HMSA.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Olson Trust, envisioning a Hawaii where its people are supported by the land, and the land is taken care of by its people. OlsonTrust.com.
Music.
Super typhoon Sinlaku hit the Western Pacific a few months back, and recovery has been slow. It made a bad situation worse, particularly in Chuuk. Here with more on the story is Honolulu Civil Beat's Chad Blair. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yes, so you got wind of a report that looks at some of the infrastructure out in Micronesia.
Yeah, you know, as part of the Compact of Free Association agreements between three Micronesian nations, and that includes the Federated States of Micronesia, which includes Chuuk, that's the Republic of the Marshall Islands, and the Republic of Palau. So as part of that treaty that the United States has with all three nations, is that there has to be a report from the U.S. government on whether the components of that treaty are being honored, in particular, whether the money that the U.S. is giving or plans to give to the three COFA nations is being spent wisely. It's a lot of money. It's about $6 billion between now and 2043. The U.S. has already spent tens of million dollars in the region. This new report from the Government Accountability Office says it's not going too well. There are some serious problems, particularly when it comes to building medical facilities, and of course that directly impacts people hurt by the storm out there in Chuuk, but also educational facilities. Why are they having problems? They can't find skilled workers to take these jobs because they're all moving to the mainland and to Guam and to Hawaii.
Yeah, it's a serious issue. I mean, we're grappling with workforce issues here, but it's so much harder in those remote areas.
Right, and as part of the COFA agreements, it's visa-free travel from those nations. And they're coming here for any number of reasons. They're coming for health purposes because the facilities are not great there. They're coming for education. They are not great facilities out there either. They're also coming because their family members have already moved to Guam and CNMI and Hawaii. Arkansas has a huge Marshallese population. And more they're coming because of global warming. Many of these islands are very low-lying. They're only a few feet above sea level. So it's a serious problem. Now, we should say that the GAO report has indicated that particularly the FSM and the RMI, they are making some progress in terms of filing the reports. But in some cases, these reports have not been delivered, you know, 6, 8, 10, 12 months after they are due. And the only way for the U.S. government to monitor, to make sure that money, and we're talking tens of million dollars each year to these nations, whether that money is being spent wisely, is through these very same reports. Having said that, there's also some frustrations on the COFA nation side. New people come in, new administrations. The Trump administration takes over for Biden. Biden took over for Trump. Relationships, and I know you know this, are so important in Micronesia where the populations are so small and they're so remotely scattered. Communication is a challenge. And to just get used to one administration when a new one comes in can be jarring. And there have been some problems with staffing U.S. agencies that are at the front lines of these COFA agreements.
Well, we do want to be, mindful. Let's hold folks accountable, right? If they're supposed to do things. But at the same time, are we doing enough, is the U.S. doing enough to help these nations, stay on the path and be accountable for that spending?
Right. Ed Case, our U.S. congressman, one of two who focuses heavily on this region, did respond to me for this article. And he said, really, we need to have greater oversight. And while there's fault on both sides, we are not doing, meaning the U.S., the COFA nations, good enough job to make sure this money is getting where it needs to go. He lays some of that blame with the current administration, whose focus has been elsewhere. But, I can just tell you, historically, the U.S. has tended to neglect this area, even though it's 2 million square miles, even though the U.S. has a strategic relationship. I mean, essentially, we have defensive control over this region. And guess who's paying attention? China. That is the larger question that's not being addressed. Well, China cannot just openly go in and give money and put defense forces into the region. You just can't do that. They are gradually spending money, particularly in the FSM, particularly in Palau, trying to make inroads, trying to get support. Of course, they have their own interest in the greater Pacific. So This is another warning that comes from this GAO report, Government Accountability Office.
Yes, yes, but important, because this area is often overlooked. But thank you so much for your story, Chad.
Thanks, Catherine.
We've been hearing from Honolulu Civil Beach, Chad Blair. You can read his stories at civilbeat.org. For the first time, scientists are using drones to monitor an elusive species of marine mammal that lives in the waters off Hawaii. False killer whales are not whales at all, but a type of social dolphin. But their small numbers and curious personalities make them difficult to track and observe. Scientists at the Pacific Whale Foundation on Maui found that they could accurately measure the size and estimate the weight of Hawaii's false killer whales using aerial drone videos. The results reveal startling fluctuations in the conditions of these rare dolphins. Jens Curry is a chief scientist at the Pacific Whale Foundation. He spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about the new research and this fascinating species that numbers fewer than 150 in the islands.
The species as a whole is distributed throughout the globe and in all of our oceans. But here in Hawaii, we have a special population that evolved to call the main Hawaiian Islands their home. And so they're the only island-associated population of false killer whales. Unfortunately, their preference for these island-associated waters puts them in direct conflict and overlap with human activities and human impact. And so as early as the 1980s and 1990s, we started to see a decline in this population that uses these island-associated population. And the numbers declined drastically, and as a result of that, they were listed as endangered in 2012. And since then, they have unfortunately still been steadily declining. And so our current best estimate is 139 individuals, and we lose around 5 to 6 individuals per year. So that trend is going the wrong way. They're still listed as endangered, and I'd consider them one of the most endangered whaler dolphin populations in the U.S. right now.
That's not great news. But when you're tracking such a small endangered population, not only that, it's not as easy as, you know, every time you want to monitor this population, you just ride along and scoop them up and measure them that way. There's a real problem that scientists like you have to solve in determining the health of the individuals that still exist. So tell us a little bit about how body condition is important for measuring the health of a population of something like the false killer whales.
The use of body condition as this kind of rapid assessment of health is, I would say it was emerging probably 5 to 10 years ago, but it's fairly common now. And so we use a drone that flies around 20 to 30 feet above the animals. And that drone is equipped with an altimeter that has a laser that tells us exactly how high the drone is above the animal. And so if we know the height, we are above the water and the whale's surface is under the drone, we can then determine the exact size of a pixel. And so an image of a whale is made up of many pixels. We know the exact size of a pixel. We can then begin to measure the animal. And so what we're doing to get body condition is measure the length of that animal and then the width, in this case, along 22 segments along the body. And what that tells us is that ratio of length to width in a given point in time. And then we would expect that ratio of length to width to stay the same over time. But if we're seeing it decrease, then that animal is losing weight, becoming poorer condition. Or if it's gaining weight, we'll see that length to width ratio increase. And so these are populations that live in Hawaii year round. They don't migrate. They don't undergo these vast fasting events like we might see for humpback whales. So we expect them to stay at the same ratio of length to width or have an increasing ratio as they grow and become bigger and more healthy. Unfortunately, what we saw here was not the case. We saw large fluctuations, and then in some years we saw all the animals we measured come in at a lower than expected body condition, ultimately weight than expected for their size.
Was this the first time that anything like this with drone imaging had been done with the false killer whale population around the main Hawaiian Islands?
Yes. So the use of drones to estimate body condition was fairly popular with larger baleen whales. So think of your humpback whales, your right whales. However, smaller, faster moving animals like false killer whales are a little bit more difficult to work with. And this was the first attempt to use drones to assess these animals in terms of body condition. And so as a result of that, we did do various validation trials with false killer whales under human care to look at how accurate we are able to estimate the true size of an animal by using animals in human care at a facility in Japan. And we were able to find that our approach was within 3% of the actual body weight or mass of individuals. And so that's
pretty good.
Extremely precise and is pretty good when you consider you're getting these measurements from a surfacing animal and just looking at the dorsal side of that animal.
Exactly. And it really just seems like a creative way to study this species and these populations. I remember a couple of years ago, I spoke with a NOAA scientist, and talking to her really just cemented, like, oh my gosh, it is hard to study these creatures that move in pods, that are fast moving, that are curious of boats. And she was describing how they would come up behind the research vessel in a way that they couldn't easily sample. Yeah, just kudos to your team for coming up with a creative way to do this.
Yeah, sometimes it is a challenge just to find them. They use all of the main Hawaiian islands, so they might only be in our area for a day or so. And so it's not uncommon for us to get fewer than a dozen encounters per year. So each one is very crucial. And yeah, we need to think of creative ways we can answer the questions we need to help protect these individuals.
But you looked from 2019 to 2025 using this method. And to your earlier point that if you'd seen it stay pretty consistent, that would tell you that the population is doing relatively the same. Did it surprise you to see it fluctuate so much, especially knowing kind of the broader context of this marine heat wave that happened and all the other stressors on this population?
Yeah, I would say it was surprising to see how drastic that drop in body condition, ultimately weight, was. So one individual lost 500 pounds in just a few months.
Wow.
And so that being able to quantify that on such a precise scale is really important. But the sheer magnitude of that is crazy. It's a quarter of the body weight. And so that was definitely surprising. The other surprising aspect was that almost the entire population, at least those that we measured, could be impacted in a single year as a result of a single event. And so it just goes to show that these individuals are living on a very finite amount of energy. And kind of in this balance of, if things are good, they're probably going to continue to be good. But as soon as a few things start to add up, you have a little bit more warmer ocean temperatures, you have maybe fewer fish, they're going to see that impact almost immediately. What is positive, though, is that all the individuals, even those that lost extreme amounts of weight at the time of publication, were still known to be alive and survive. So they can undergo these really intense struggles and weight loss events and still bounce back from that. But it does show that they're highly susceptible and you know, in a sense, the time for action and more protections is now to ensure that trend reverses. We want to see them go up. We don't want to lose 5 to 6 per year. We want to gain 5 to 6 per year.
What can be done, whether it is expanding protections or some other intervention to help these false killer whales with their body weight, with their condition?
Yeah, I mean, I think we'd look to policy and legislation. And the one ask we would have is to protect false killer whales' prey base today based on this work. And so that can be done through ecosystem-based management that ultimately protects the productivity of waters around the main Hawaiian islands, but works in conjunction with fisheries. So not against, but ensuring that both false killer whales can thrive and fishermen can have livelihood that's sustainable. But that requires some next steps in terms of monitoring, better monitoring of existing fisheries, better monitoring of catch rates, and better monitoring of trends of some of those key prey items we know that false killer whales rely on. And so that, I'd say, is what the next step we can do in terms of action and better protections. But the other is greater awareness. So if the general public hears this message and they're like, boy, I never heard of a false killer whale, and the story is, it's kind of sad. There's still hope, and we do need public support to move action forward. That's just the way science works. And so we're hoping to create more, let's call them false killer whale advocates. So if you hear this message, share it far and wide. We have a petition you can sign. You can email me to stay in touch and become a false killer whale advocate. So when the time comes for additional asks and better management, we have a large body of the public available and willing to support that. and we can probably see some better action in terms of protections.
Yeah, I could even see researchers who study other marine mammals or organisms take your methodology of using drones and apply it to their study population.
Yeah, I think drones will serve as a rapid assessment tool. So if you think of historical ways to monitor populations, you're basically counting the whales year over year, and then every year you look, is the number going up or down? Maybe one year it goes up, or maybe one year it goes down, and then you have to wait and see if that's potentially a long-term trend or not. However, with drones, we can look at the individual and tell in that point in time, is that individual healthy or not? And if it's not, then there's something going on that's impacting that individual and potentially the population if you have many individuals that are in this poor condition. And so it serves as a very valuable tool, not only for false killer whales, but as a tool to monitor whales and dolphins in today's world of changing climates.
Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Maddie. I appreciate it.
That was Jens Curry and HPR's Maddie Bender. We'll have links to the new research on our website after today's show.
Support for HPR comes from Pacific American Lumber on Oahu, offering wood flooring from UA Floors. Its Hawaiian collection of engineered wood features mango and monkey pod from Hawaii Island. PACAMLumber.com.
Tune in to HPR 2 on Sunday at 3 p.m. to hear the internationally acclaimed vocal ensemble Apollo 5 at the Cathedral of St. Andrew in downtown Honolulu. We'll hear iconic works by Alec Roth, Orlando Di Lasso, William Byrd, and Benjamin Britten, as well as modern favorites including Summertime by George Gershwin and Fly Me to the Moon by Bart Howard. That's Sunday at 3 p.m. on HPR 2.
Support for HPR comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, with locations in Moanalua and Kaneohe, offering dine-in and take-out daily and catering available for business meetings and events. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
It's been a month since Kalaupapa lost a longtime resident who held a license to operate tours at the historic settlement. The tours abruptly were halted last week following a memorial service. HPR's Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel joins us live. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, and I think some people were under the impression that maybe those tours would go on to the end of the calendar year, but that's not what happened.
That's not. So one of the many legacies of Auntie Meli Watanuki was the tours, the Kalaupapa Saints tours that she owned and operated. And as you said, they did come to an end last week. The family decided that after her passing, they would go ahead and close the tours. The National Park Service did have a permit or had issued a permit for them to operate through the end of the year. But honoring her family's wishes, they did go ahead and close them. And guests who had paid for tours will receive a full refund. And, you know, it's not known yet whether another patient resident will restart those tours or whether, you know, the regulations might change. It is a requirement currently that a living patient resident be the one operating those tours. And so lots of discussion ahead, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But I was able to speak with Auntie Meli's niece in Kalaupapa, Rosa Key, and also with two of her friends in faith, sisters of St. Francis Newman Communities, the same congregation that St. Marianne belonged to. And they shared memories together. And it was really nice to be able to talk story about Auntie Meli and her life, you know, Sister Alicia Damien Lau and Sister Barbara Jean Vita, you know, they all just described her as this joyful person, so full of life, you know, never taking a break, full of faith, you know, really devout Catholic, really just, you know, a twinkle in her eye, a little spark of, you know, mischief and playfulness. And, you know, the Kalaupapa community is very rural, as many people know. It's a super remote community. And regulations there don't really exist the way they do in many other places. Sister Barbara Jean recalls a story that shows Auntie Mellie's strong faith as well as her spunky spirit.
This aging lady who is very short in stature, but not short in too much other stuff. A little plane landed at the airport when Mellie and I were the only ones there. These two young guys come out and they said, "Where's the nearest restaurant? We're hungry." And we said, "There is no restaurant. There is no gas station. There is no shopping mall. There is nothing." And they were about ready to wheel into her and try to see if they could maneuver her. And I was wordless. And she says, "You will have to get out of here right now. Get in your plane and fly away. Go away. You're not allowed here." So I asked her, "Aren't you afraid then to be down there alone?" And she says, "I am never alone." She says, "I always have Saint Father Damien, Saint Mother Mary Ann, and Joseph Dutton. And I talk to them, they talk to me, I sing, I pray, and they keep me safe." And that is like the kernel of faith that was just such a central part of who she was as a person.
Yeah, very religious.
Absolutely. You know, she had the opportunity to travel to Rome several times. She met the Pope. She had the honor of transporting a relic of Father Damien, and she attended both the canonizations of Saints Damien and Marianne. Very, very well traveled. She was born in American Samoa in 1934, grew up in a village, small village there. She was diagnosed with Hansen's disease when she was 18, and she did get treatment. She moved to Oahu when she was in her mid-20s, I think, and she ended up moving to Kalaupapa later voluntarily. She was one of the last patient residents to move there in 1969 when the policy of exile for Hansen's disease patients was lifted. She decided that she wanted to move there to be closer to friends, and, you know, that was home for her for the rest of her life. And, you know, just always a smile. I met her several times. I remember going down for the annual barge day one year, and she, you know, was just out in front of the general store that she ran down there in the community. And, you know, it was just always so nice to see her and to talk story. The roads in Kalaupapa are, as we said, you know, very rural community, not a lot of rules about the roads. But her niece Rosa Key talked about those everyday moments that she'll miss. And you'll hear Sister Alicia chiming in here as well about her Auntie Mellie's driving.
I remember she gets off work at 11 o'clock, and then she passes by my office and honks the horn, and everybody in my office is like, "Auntie's outside." They recognize the horn because she seems like she's the only one that honks the horn in this place. Honks the horn, I come outside. "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm at work. I'm at my office." And she goes, "What time you get up?" You know, that kind of every day, I will tremendously miss that. And just knowing that she's not going to come by anymore. And I'm sure, you know, the community will miss this little short lady coming around, driving her car that everybody, they don't have the nerve to step up and say, "You cannot drive anymore," after all these other aspects. They refuse to take the key from her.
Somebody said to me, "You know, I saw a car, but I didn't see any driver. I saw two dogs."
She's so short. Yeah, she's so short in stature. But she, her little putt-putt little car that goes by very slowly. And I remember asking her, "You shouldn't be shouldn't be driving anymore, right? Because you have all those accidents. And what does the state tell you to not drive anymore? No, nobody's going to tell me what to do. So they just hope for the best when she's on the road.
Oh, what a sweet memories.
Yeah. Oh, so her services were held on Oahu and in Kalaupapa over the past few weeks, and they were both packed, over 600 people on Oahu, you know, just a testament to how many people she touched. And at both services, they sang a Samoan farewell song. Here's a quick clip.
Yeah, that's really sweet, a Samoan farewell song. You know, she was Samoan, and important to acknowledge that. But thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
We've been talking to HBR's Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel. You can read more about this story online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Costco Air Conditioning and Refrigeration, featuring Daikin Air Conditioning Systems. Listing of contractors installing Daikin products, that's D-A-I-K-I-N, at CostcoHawaii.com.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and the next Freakonomics Radio. In his final years, the great physicist Richard Feynman went to some surprising places.
Some of his best work was actually done in these corners where nobody else had gone.
We'll get into his 11th hour adventure into a new state of mind.
He was lying on the same couch staring at a banana for 3 hours.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Beginning this evening at 7, following The Daily.
Support for HPR comes from Aloha Air Cargo, connecting Hawaii by providing inter-island shipping, with services including Aloha Next Flight Out, Aloha Standard Overnight, and Aloha Economy. AlohaAirCargo.com.
For the first time, Hawaii will host a tribute to what's called Cinema of Despair. It's called Bleak Week. The Doris Duke Theater at the Honolulu Museum of Art will showcase emotionally challenging cinema for 4 days next week. The idea for Bleak Week came from the Los Angeles-based organization American Cinematheque, which started its own week of sorrow and dread back in 2022. Doris Duke's theater manager and programmer Sarah Fang spoke with HPR's Kevin Allen about Honolulu's Bleak Week. Fang starts us off with a very simple question.
When you think of a film that's described as beautiful, is it always a happy film? You know, when you think of beautiful films, they're usually kind of sad. You know, they're usually very full of despair and tragedy. And for me, there's really nothing like that feeling of feeling like your heart just got gouged out to really see the beauty in the world as well. And I think that really just highlights what these sort of sadder films do.
And so there is going to be a lot of beauty on display then coming up here for Bleak Week. And it seems like it's kind of picking up steam. It's a week-long film showcase that really showcases what you just kind of described. Beautiful, but intensely kind of sad or at times depressing or just very emotionally complex pieces of cinema. So describe to me, what is Bleak Week? It's in its fifth year. Talk to me all about it.
So Bleak Week is actually a program that was started by American Cinematheque, who run a few theaters in Los Angeles. They started in 2022. And, you know, it was just a way of really collecting all these like harder, more challenging films and putting it together and, you know, creating that communal experience of it. And this is our first year participating in it, and it's their fifth year, and it's kind of amazing to see how much it's grown. It really started only with the Aero Theater and the Los Feliz in Los Angeles, but this year I believe they've gone to over 70-something cities, different countries. It's almost, I believe it's over 100 theaters are participating this year. And what's really great is that, you know, it's really just sort of doing things collectively together, all these art house theaters, but we still have a lot of control in terms of the programming. So every theater picks their own films. They pick a week in June to do it, whatever works for them. And so it's really interesting to see what everyone else is doing.
Yeah, it is all curated. So if you could describe to our listeners, what is the Doris Duke Theater doing? What was your vision kind of coming into this as a curator?
For me, you know, being in our inaugural year, I felt like it was so important to really highlight the place where we are. And I, you know, one of my number one priorities was to make sure that our lineup included local or Native Hawaiian voices. And so I'm very proud that we have two in them. We have Beyond Paradise from 1998, for those of you who know. And then we also have Chris Kahunahana's Waikiki from 2020.
And it's something that I think is so interesting about having Bleak Week in Hawaii, right? Like, Hawaii is this place where there is just this inexpressible amount of beauty. But then underneath that, there is a dark undercurrent. Like, it's not all what it seems to be. So talk to me more about how the films that you just mentioned, Waikiki and Beyond Paradise, kind of capture that duality. And what is your take on that?
For sure. I think in the history of cinema, Hawaii, like from the times of Elvis coming over, it's been promoted and seen as this beautiful paradise where people can escape to. Everything's warm, everything's beautiful, the sun is shining all the time. But, you know, as someone who lives here, we realize that, you know, not everything is so joyful. It is, you know, a bit, especially in these times, it's a bit hard to live here. You know, there is a lot that's hiding behind that paradise. And so these films, I think, really show the reality behind the paradise of Hawaii.
You could say it goes beyond paradise.
Yes. Exactly.
And I think, speaking of Beyond Paradise, to me, that is like the definition of like a small independent film, kind of really making a name for itself. It does have a bit of a cult following. It gained some traction on social media recently. And I think in the world we are in right now, where it's just these huge blockbuster releases and a lot of remakes and not a huge focus on originality. You know, why do you think there needs to be like a bigger focus on these kind of smaller independent flicks? And why do you think it's so important to kind of support these small kind films?
I mean, I think independent cinema is where the most creative people are. Being scrappy and creative really just generates some of the most original ideas. And a film like Beyond Paradise, which is really just very much a if you know, you know film here, just shows this small community in Kona Waena, which like most people out of Hawaii probably wouldn't even know where that is. And just like the real life there of the 90s.
Just the real life.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think a great thing about Bleak Week is that it is a place where even as a film enthusiast, you can see something new. You know, there's really quite an array. And something that I found really quite surprising is that there's a film by Guillermo del Toro here. You have his work, The Devil's Backbone, on here. Mm-hmm. You know, tell me why you went with that choice and kind of, you know, maybe a bit of a hidden gem maybe in his collection of work.
Yeah, definitely. Well, first off, you know, we have two films in our program that are celebrating anniversaries. And The Devil's Backbone is actually celebrating its 25th anniversary. So I feel like we just really like to celebrate those milestones first and foremost. But I feel like, yes, as you described, The Devil's Backbone is kind of more of a hidden gem in his filmography. Of course, in recent years, you know, he won an Oscar for The Shape of Water. You know, he did his huge kaiju robot, you know, action-packed Pacific Rim, which is a personal favorite of mine. But The Devil's Backbone is really just the story that talks about the horrors of war and really the ghosts that we leave behind. I love Guillermo del Toro's films because of sort of, I guess, magicalness, the magical surrealism in his films. And, you know, he just creates these wonderful environments. And The Devil's Backbone is very much this beautiful and haunting ghost story in a war-torn Spain.
You know, the creation of films, or even just art like this too, is sometimes an effect of something really personal kind of coming to light. And as someone who's watched a lot of cinema, do you find an added layer of kind of that emotional vulnerability apparent in movies like this, where there it really is, again, as you'd kind of used the phrase before, challenging and maybe a product of the filmmaker's own personal issues coming to light?
Very much so. I feel like, you know, I think any artist who makes a piece of art, there is always a piece of themselves in it. And so I think a lot of Guillermo del Toro's experiences are, you know, and his interests and his loves are all in his films. But I think that's also really apparent in something like A Peach Upon Wida Setako's Uncle Bunmi, Who Can Dream of Past Lives. But that's also, I feel like, such a personal film as well, that's very much set in his own homeland and its own history and its own trauma, and really explores that.
And again, it is a little challenging to watch at times, you know, seeing such emotional vulnerability, I think sometimes as a viewer can be like exposing for yourself, right? Like you're exposing yourself to this. I guess, do you have any tips or, like, you know, for people who maybe aren't super ready to come into this, you know, they don't watch a lot of cinema, but they want to give it a try. I mean, do you have any tips just kind of getting yourself into the right mindset for coming into something like Bleak Week?
I hope that by calling it Bleak Week and the Cinema of Despair, we're really setting up people correctly. But, you know, I think I do want people to come with open hearts, maybe knowing that those hearts might get a little gouged out. There are some really, a few of the films we have, like Come and See, Incendie, you know, they really portray some horrific moments in the reality of the world we live in. But I think watching something like this can, you know, also help us make sense of the madness of the world and provide context. I feel like art in any form really is just a manifestation of the feelings that we all have, and really helps us stay grounded and understand a little bit more about what's going on. But I think what I also really... And I think this is the power of the communal experience. When you do experience something that is really heartbreaking and, you know, you just feel it in your gut afterwards, what's really great is being able to talk about it afterwards. And so what I love and what I really believe in is the communal experience of cinema. Because if you're watching something like Come and See by yourself at home, you're just kind of stuck at home by yourself, like, whoa, what did I just experience? I need to call a friend right now. But I hope that for people who come to see these screenings at our theater, when they come out of the theater, they're able to talk to these other people around, these strangers at the start of this experience. But now they're someone that you've experienced something with together. And to be able to talk about, that's what I love the most, really, about my job, is really that feeling after something amazing has happened. We've created this like brand new experience for someone, and people just gather on their own and they start talking about it. People who've never met each other before, people who are just like, hey man, this was really rough. Can we talk about it for a little bit? Or like, oh my gosh, that was so amazing. I really love this. And, you know, just coming together.
That was Sarah Fang of the Honolulu Museum of Art's Doris Duke Theater. She spoke with HPR's Kevin Allen about Bleak Week. It's running from June 25th to June 28th. Find links to the full schedule on our website later today. And that is a wrap for today. Tomorrow, we continue our coverage of the Obama Presidential Center and meet a librarian, the Library Commissioner, with Hawaii ties. Share your comments or questions by calling our TalkBack line, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.